Happy 2024 and welcome back to Asset Horizon on Zero Books. A couple of years ago on Asset Horizon, we discussed the anti-fascism of Wilhelm Reich, reading his collection of essays entitled The Mass Psychology of Fascism, and I'll include a link to that show in the show notes. Since then, we have intended to go back and take a closer look at the psychological theories of Reich, his view on science and epistemology, as well as some of his theories' philosophical precursors. Today with us, we have Dan Lowe, who has long been recommended to me as an expert on Reich's work, and who is a practicing therapist and counselor in London, and whose work is informed by Reich's ideas, at least partly. And with that said, the ambit of our conversation today hopes to include a wide range of topics within Reich's life and his writing, but we'll pay particular attention to some of the practices and challenges involved with Reichian therapy. Dan, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thanks so much. It's lovely to be here. Yeah, it's always strange when you hear yourself described as an expert.
Well, you, on Twitter, you are Orgone One, so you are set up for that. Well, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, your practice, your background, and your familiarity with this work.
Sure. Well, I'm a psychotherapist. I'm based in London. I was a teacher previously, and I retrained in 2017. I did an MA in Integrative Relational Psychotherapy at Roehampton University, and I started seeing clients in 2018. The thing that led me to that, to retrain, was doing 4.5 years of Reichian psychotherapy with a therapist in London, Deirdre Goff, and that in itself came out of a long-standing interest in Reich. I wrote my dissertation about Reich in the 90s, and well, when I was at university in the 90s, which was, you know, it wasn't very good. It was largely a rip-off of Myron Sharif's big biography. But Reich has remained an interest since then. And I think I first came to him because I read something about mass psychology of fascism. I'd always been interested in politics, and yet it somehow struck me as missing something, or being a bit, you know, the shallowness of so much politics. And a guy who was bringing me emotional and psychological into politics, that seemed worth reading and hearing about. So that was what first got me interested. And then he cropped up in my studies, and he's remained an interest ever since. And I finally got to do some Reichian therapy started about 2013, maybe a little bit earlier. I found it absolutely incredible. I found it, you know, like you can take up all sorts of disciplines and they kind of do something and you have to work it and bodge things around. I found the psychotherapy that I did really very immediate, very powerful, very changed me a lot. And yeah, and it was, I'd regularly experience, I think, kind of vistas of health and happiness that I didn't know were possible. And that's my fascination, basically. And after being interested in Reich for so long, that was kind of strangely validating, you know. I knew it was good, but I didn't expect it to be that good, but it was.
And well, that's fascinating to hear. And I think that's something that our listeners, we recently did an episode on a Freudian trained psychotherapist who has somewhat disavowed Freud, but nonetheless uses some of the methodology. It's interesting to hear a success story as well. I would certainly like to get to that, but maybe we should get an overview of Reich's theories, particularly this idea of orgone. What the hell is orgone, and how did Reich attempt to ground his theories? I think one of the obstacles that some people have with respect to taking Reich seriously is that there's a popular image of him as an eccentric who peddled a kind of pseudoscience, right? And he has this theory of orgasmic flows of energy, and in its caricature, it seems quite a bit like maybe like the qi of like Eastern or traditional Chinese medicine, or maybe something like mana. But based on, you had us read a couple of things. One was Morton Herskovitz's Emotional Armoring. And then you also had us read the first two chapters of Reich's own Ether, God, and Devil. And what I found fascinating about that was, he really goes at lengths to defend himself as a scientist. One of the things about Reich is that he's, arguably a very rigorous positivist, not to mention that he has his own theory of functional ergonomics, and it has what he thinks are two targets that are historically flawed, two theoretical dispositions, what he calls the mechanistic view of nature and then the mystical view of nature. And maybe perhaps to start off, you could address like what Orgone is, what Reich was trying to achieve, and if it makes any sense to do so, like what are the kinds of psychological views that he's pushing back against?
Basically, if you engage with Reich, you have to engage with his ideas about energy. And he felt he had discovered an energy that he called Orgone. Now, and you could see that as an attempt to rewrite a life energy back into kind of Western biology, really, if you like. So not dissimilar idea to Qi or Prana, but an attempt to sort of have a new biology that incorporated that. And like he failed, yeah? It got him in. Having that energetic perspective was really the thing that got him in legal trouble in the 50s in America. I mean, it's a bit more complex than that, but I'll come back to that if necessary. But it was very clear that he felt Orgone was real. And if you're reading him, you have to read him with that in mind. You have to go, yeah, because you know, I'm not saying people should believe it, but it wasn't, it's not a metaphor for Reich. It's something that's real and concrete, that's experienced in therapy. Reich thought it was present in the atmosphere as well. Just to go back a bit, he says if he discovered anything, the coastal stretch from which all the rest of his work developed was the idea of pulsation. And that's the idea of things contracting and expanding, things in nature contracting and expanding, from cells to organs to individual humans. A question I'll often ask people in therapy is, you know, do you feel quite contracted today? And I see the therapeutic work I'm trying to do is trying to move them to a place of expansion. And he's sort of in, you know, systems greater than us, in weather systems, for instance. So you've already got this mode of inquiry, which, unlike Western science, which specializes and looks at smaller and smaller parts, it links things up. It links things up and it looks for common principles across them. So already it's, yeah, anathema to kind of Western science. So he's got this idea of pulsation. And that, if you're thinking about pulsation, you've got to say, well, what is pulsating? Reich would say it's Orgone. It's a type of energy that is pulsating and it moves. And his psychotherapy is, in a way, is looking at where the organism might be blocked and contracted and where the energy is kind of bound, and it's looking at freeing that, basically. And I don't expect anybody listening to take that on board or to just believe that because I've asserted it so. But one of the interesting things about it is that it was such a creative idea for Reich. It was generative of so much, so many insights, so many ideas, so much creativity, as in the reading, you know. That's, you know, he's got some quite interesting, fascinating, sophisticated ideas emerging there from this idea. And as you know, the caricature of Reich is that he's mad. And I really just want to get people reading Reich and looking at him and kind of considering that he might not be, or that there might, which doesn't say I expect people to believe in the reality of organic energy. I'm ambivalent about it myself sometimes, but more to sort of take him seriously as a thinker, and thinking with this unorthodox idea can actually take you places. An example of that might be with this idea of pulsation and looking for what Reich calls a common functioning principle across different realms. That idea of pulsation in human biology, it kind of unifies lots of different processes. So laughter, crying, being sick, vomiting, orgasm, and even birth. They all have a pulse. Obviously, they're very different. They're very different phenomena, but a Reichian would look at them and notice the pulsatory aspect and be thinking, can, for instance, could like the birth process maybe be improved, or be, could a difficult birth be helped by the idea of, by allowing freer pulsation? what happens in the therapy room if I notice that someone's breathing is quite contracted, and I get them to breathe in a freer way. Their breathing begins, and I can get their breathing to pulse a little. What kind of happens? So it's an idea that I would argue in favour of it just by looking at how generative it is. And, yeah, is that helpful?
That's great. I'll just ask one more question to get the others in here too, and maybe to kind of shore up an argument to be an advocate for Reich here too. I'd like to repurpose an argument, an analogy that we found in the Herskovitz book on emotional armoring. So Reich has this concept he calls armoring or emotional armoring, and it's one that is manifested individually, but there is perhaps even a sort of cosmic dimension to it, where there's in the universe, forces go to the limit of what they can do. They express themselves in a full range of capacity, but there are times at which, due to emotional trauma or some kind of binding force, they cannot do that. And in the case of emotional armoring, you know, somebody has internalized trauma to the extent that they can't act in certain ways, and then that expression comes out in the form of various repetitions or habits, maybe habits the way that we use our eyes and hold our eyes or hold our body and so forth. Part of me wants to say that it's almost incontestable that with respect to trauma, there's ways that we embody that. There's a certain physical dimension to it, and that it enters into our body and then is expressed even unconsciously. The question is, for us going forward, is Reich's concept of emotional armoring and the theory of therapeutics that's entailed, is that sufficient to both diagnose and elicit some kind of quote-unquote cure or release that energy? And maybe we have to simply talk practically about this. So if you want to talk either in terms of what you have experienced inside the therapist room or maybe experiences that you have as a therapist, and then maybe we can work our way sort of back towards the theory and some of the problems or challenges that we may have with it.
Sure. Do you want me to give a quick account maybe of what armoring is?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, most succinct definition I've heard was from my supervisor, who described it as, who said it's the physiological side of emotional repression. And this is an idea. It tends to appeal to most people. Most people tend to get this. You have an idea that your emotional range is a bit limited. It doesn't feel as full as it could be. And that's somehow bound up with our bodies and our expression and how our body expresses itself, whether it's breathing or movement or whatever, or tensions that we're aware of. Most people seem to sort of resonate with that idea. And it doesn't require organs for that idea to function. Reich writes about two sorts of armoring, the characterological and the muscular. And the muscular would be what's taking place on a bodily level. It might be a tight jaw, say, for instance. And the characterological will be the character attitude. Like a tight jaw might express a sort of stubbornness or something. And a Reichian therapist will work on both prongs of that fork, so to speak. And this is the idea that is expressed in the diagram you get on the cover of all of Reich's books. You get two arrows emerging from an underlying line. What that represents is how two phenomena that seem antithetical are actually a unity. So psych and soma seem opposed, but in Reich, they're part of the same living process. And he got that idea from dialectical materialism, actually, from his Marxist days. Two things that seem in antithesis but are actually a unity. And psych and soma is one of them. Character armor, muscular armor is another one. And I do actually find that quite a useful idea when I'm working with people. I have some clients who I don't work with physically at all, but I still regard myself as working on my character armor. And I have some clients who I work with quite a lot physically, and I regard that as working on the muscular armor. But it's still the same thing. It's still trying to free up what Reich would probably call movement. It's trying to free up some expression and movement.
Could you just give an example of a common, like, malady, problem, pathology, as you might see it, that somebody comes into therapy with, and what is a particular approach that you have to dealing with that?
Do you want me to give you an example from my own therapy?
If you don't mind, or you can create a hypothetical based on one that you've had.
Yeah. I've used this anecdote before, but it's quite a handy experience to have because it's quite anecdote sized, so to speak. And I was working with a German therapist in a kind of open workshop situation at a retreat. And she was working on my jaw, and she got me to bite a towel at one stage, and just sort of, you know, not really hard, but just you know, expressing some aggression through my jaw. And the session went on for about, it wasn't just that, it was loads and loads of other moves as well, and it went on for about 90 minutes. And at the end, I felt a little bit, didn't really experience anything particularly amazing. I wonder what happened there. But then I noticed that my jaw felt smaller. So that's interesting. And then I further noticed an attitude change. And I felt like this was felt physically, and I'm going to translate it into words, but that was, I felt like I didn't have to defend myself anymore. So I just felt, not only was it wasn't like I dropped a defense, it was just like I didn't need to defend myself. So what that tells me, what I would hypothesize from that there was a kind of aggressive defensiveness that was just being carried in my jaw, maybe pushing my jaw out slightly or tensing my jaw somehow. And she got me to release that. And the release of a somatic tension made the character attitude of defensiveness drop away. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. You know, that's a personal share, so that's important and intimate as well. Yeah, Adam or Will, by all means, hop in.
I mean, yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Dan. All the time I think about Reich, I always think of not so much of, because I'm not a Reichian, but I have some strong sympathies, especially for the early mass psychology stuff, particularly because I remember once when I was, God, I can't remember how old I was, but it was 2016, and I went to this exhibition. It was called the Institute of Sexology, and it was the introduction to the field of sexology. And then I picked up this one book on, I think, oh, it's supposed to be a sexy book by Wilhelm Reich. I just sat in this weird box, cool, and I open it, and it's a discussion of the Soviet Congresses of like 1928 and 1929. And I think it's good that you brought up the dialectical materialism aspect there, because it's not so much that Reich isn't weird, so much as the rest of the things we think of in sort of theory, philosophy, science that aren't weird actually are. I mean, this idea of pulsation, this is the dynamic critique of mechanism that goes all the way back to anyone after Newton. In philosophy, we have it from Kant to Schelling. Kant has a theory of ether. He thinks that towards the end of his life, that the conditions of our experience of ourselves are this thing called ether, and we are ripples in its energetic process. We don't, Kant's wrong about a lot of things scientifically, but, you know, in terms of the history of the weirdness, and also just the description of orgonomic functionalism, his idea of trying to find a path or a non-dualistic path between the mystic and the mechanical. That happened in the 20th century. That was called cybernetics, in which we assign various things functions, but whatever you put amongst those functions wasn't named, whereas for Reich it was orgon. And so I just found it really fascinating just going through that axiomatic. I mean, one question I have in terms of the contemporary reception of Reich, I know there's been, in one side, there's been a move to reappraise Reich as a scientist, because there's a brilliant book by James Strick, who did like the archival research and went into like Reich's early experiments on not orgon, but bions. So like basically trying to do beginning of life studies and inventing actually coming up with some really fascinating techniques in electron microscopy, which we still haven't replicated yet, but there's definitely a PhD in there somewhere. But there's also this contemporary side of the not the weird, but more sort of the marketable weird, you know, the the crystals, those weird sort of sparkly black jewelry things that charge up. Yeah, if anyone's in London, you can go to Greenwich Market. There's a London Orgone store. Do they sell those boxes? No. But I just want to ask what you thought of the contemporary reception of Reich across these sort of two poles of reappraisement and kind of kitsch, I guess.
I mean, you know, you can probably guess I would much more align myself with Jim Strict than some crystal shop selling organite pyramids or whatever. But this, I suppose one thing I'd say about the organite and all that stuff, there's never any rigor around that stuff. There's not people doing, well, maybe there are, you know, maybe there are some people doing experiments. But it seems like a pretty kind of independent, new age marketing gadget, end of the market, and it sits alongside everything else from, you know, from dowsing mods to tarot cards to whatever, and it's just another bit of frippery. And it's like, well, you know, okay. I don't necessarily hate it, but I don't see it. There's nothing there that really interests me. Whereas Jim Strick's work, that book is incredible. And I think it's the best book on Reich since his death, largely because he's had access to the archives. Reich asked for his archives to be closed up 50 years after his death. So they only opened in 2008. More of the kind of work that I'd like to see, you know, stuff that takes it seriously. One of the things about Reich as eccentric, as an eccentric and a lunatic, he's quite safe. You know, we know about this guy, he was mad. One of the things that really gets on my nerves is, like, newspapers like The Guardian, they take up Reich and they write about him, and I think they almost see him as their own because he was pro-sex and anti-fascist. But they won't take his ideas actually seriously. I wouldn't dream of reading a book by him, how I got onto that point, but it's always good to slag off The Guardian. I hope you agree. The only thing that makes me sad is that Jim Strick's book, I don't know how many copies it sold or how widely it's read, but I don't really see signs of a wider reappraisal of Reich, you know, maybe a little bit, not much.
I mean, the only sort of recent book I can think of that even deals with Reich in sort of popular culture is Olivia Lang's book, yeah. Everybody. And I haven't actually read that. I don't know how much of a Reichian sort of focus it has.
I wrote a long thread about it on Twitter, slagging it off because I don't like it very much. And she takes a standard position on Reich, which is like, oh, he was mad. He was eccentric. And also, when you know her sources, you can see it's actually pretty shallow. She borrowed most of her... She didn't do any original research, and most of it is borrowed from a book called Journeys in the Orgasmatron by... I can't remember the name of the author, but it came out a couple of years ago by some London Review of Books guy, which is also... Yeah, which is more of the same, you know. Reich was mad. And why I wanted to get you guys and anyone else, you know, reading Reich is you read, like, Aether, God and Devil, and you think, well, there's something going on here. There's active intellectual work here, and there's original ideas here. And, yeah, which Lang's book, no, doesn't really do that. It says, yeah, oh, he was interesting. He was an interesting psychotherapist. The body stuff is good. All the energy stuff, he was mad. And yeah, it's a pretty standard line, really. The other thing I'd say about that book, Jim Strick was joking, and he said, I'm going to do a scientific biography of Reich. How do I get it down from a projected 1,500 pages to a mere 500? Lang's book is 300 pages long. About 20% of it is about Reich. So, you know, and it's written in a light, poppy paperback style. So, yeah, it's not that deep, really.
So there's one thing that I think is, so we've been talking a lot about sort of energy and pulsation.
but not about the object with which Reich is going to sort of tether a lot of historical, and I know we're not supposed to say philosophical because Reich is like very clear. It's like, oh, what I'm doing is not philosophy. But let's just say like psychosocial. He's going to tie a lot of his psychosocial conceptual critiques to this notion of like staticness of whether it's the absolute when he sort of slashes at Kant, or, you know, when he, I mean, he essentially does the same thing to Schopenhauer, which he calls like a disaster. Schopenhauer in philosophy is a disaster. And all of this he ascribes to a kind of everything from, you know, the bad conscience that comes from, you know, internalized absolute morality to the notion of inherited guilt, these things to the notion of the absolute. All of these things are kind of tied to the static or this kind of strange immutability. You know, he puts the, there's this great, very, I think in the first chapter, there's this diagram of the realms of human thought, and he puts this concept of blame in everything. So in the life element, heredity is to blame. In the cosmic problem of existence, like sin is to blame. So I'm wondering whether it's guilt or the stasis of a kind of essentialist biologization of the human being to even just the immutability of the evil will of man. There seems to be this interrelation between the static and the mobile, and how does this inform a Reichian as they navigate sort of what do you isolate with like an Analizand as being the static problem versus trying to move towards this more mobile approach?
I would say probably an easy way to get your head around that is to take it back to the body and to think about, what does it feel like when I tense my stomach and keep my chest still? What does it feel like? And probably going to say it feels a little bit unpleasant. So what I do a lot is I try and mobilize people's breathing. I try and get the movement to return. And everybody breathes differently. And breathing is as kind of personal as handwriting in a way, when you spend a lot of time looking at it. But one thing I would pretty much always be trying to do is kind of see what happens when the breathing starts to move. I'm often quite surprised at how rapid, with my own breathing, how rapid the changes in emotion can be. 3 or 4 breaths and, yeah, things start changing for me. And in clients, not all the time, but in clients where I do manage to mobilise the breathing and get them to move a bit, that's often the way in which you begin to start the sort of snowballing process of emotional change. And looking at specific points where you're held. I have a lot of tension here, for instance, like right at my diaphragm. And when I'm going through difficult things, it becomes more and more and more tense. I feel the sense of paralysis as something very, very embodied. So something I'll regularly try and do different exercises to try and move that. And at times I've felt just kind of new possibilities of health open up because I've managed to get that moving, because I've managed to get my diaphragm moving consistently. Sometimes it's the sensation, things just drop away. Problems and worries just kind of, yeah, they fall off. It's one of my experiences in therapy of consistently going for, you know, 4.5 years, and probably, you know, 99 times out of 100, having that experience of going in with something quite negative and after a session, feeling this new sense of spaciousness and happiness and lack of pressure. So does that answer the question at all? Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I, you know, because what I don't want to do is ask these questions and then say, oh, well, it's quite fascinating that like Nietzsche and Bergson were both important to the vitalist tradition. Like, no, that's nonsense. That's not what we're here to do. right? So what I want to try to navigate is how Reich is kind of isolating the history of thought as something that he can turn into a symptomatology that he can then deploy into the room with his Anawa's and. And like, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say he's working on several levels because there's the earlier work, which is the psychotherapeutic work. But Gori from the Devil is more of a kind of, you know, philosophical statement. But it's more of a kind of, this is what happens if we take these ideas out into the social world and start to build theories and ideas upon them. You know, so one of the things about Reich is he's very kind of intellectually promiscuous, and he doesn't really respect boundaries. He kind of strays wildly across all sorts of different fields. And he talks about it quite clearly at some point. He says he's just following the logic of his research, but that's why he's gone from psychotherapy to microbiology, from microbiology to meteorology, from observing fascism to this quite philosophical work. He consistently is following his own internal logic, which if you go with him, you can follow. But I don't think it does him any favours if you look at the amount of ground he covered. If you're trying to build the case he's a madman, then just looking at all the different fields he dipped into kind of lends evidence to that, I guess.
I think we'll probably move on to what we would consider a few critiques of Reich, or at least question the methodologies a little bit. But perhaps even before I do that, I think, well, there's a sort of relatable anecdote that I have. I had been in Jungian therapy, like in my early 20s, and I think I had some success with it. But it wasn't until maybe a few years after that that I had gone to a very strenuous, very physical kind of yoga class, where one of the moves, if you're a yoga practitioner, perhaps you know it, it's called Ustrasana, the camel pose. It's where one is on their knees and they bend backwards and compress their lower spine. And a feeling that is often evoked by doing this is a kind of sadness or overwhelming sort of like melancholy or ennui kind of feeling, but it also releasing it too. When you come out of the compression, you tend to release this feeling. And sometimes I would experience having a dry sob or even like maybe a tear roll down my cheek. And I didn't go to yoga necessarily I'm going there for the emotional benefits or the psychological benefits, but I noticed over time that, you know, developing this relationship with a kind of contraction and dilation of different parts of my body, I was slowly, unconsciously putting myself through a kind of therapy. And I mean, I think there is one way in which I'm looking at Reich's theory and I'm like, there is something there. But on the other hand, there is this issue about what I call the therapeutic tableau, where, especially if we read Morton Herskovitz's book, the picture that he presents of Reich's therapy could be pretty unnerving to somebody coming to it for the first time. And, you know, correct me if I'm mistaken, it involves an Alisands lying down on a couch in some cases, either completely nude or, you know, just in their underwear, and the analyst going around palpating parts of their body, looking for reactions, looking for changes in skin color and breathing and so forth. And one of the epistemological challenges, as I see it, is that bodies are so different, right? And react so differently to so many different things. The question of disability comes in as well, because there are particular physical or health issues that somebody might be experiencing that could be immediately overcome with breathing exercises and so forth. But if there is some contraindication or some other symptom there, perhaps the therapy could exacerbate that condition. How does a Reichian therapist navigate those problems?
Herskovitz was Reich's oldest surviving student, so presumably trained with him directly. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did. He died in 2018, and he was like, you know, 90 plus. So he would have had a kind of transmission almost from Reich, which would be quite, you might call, old school. And Reich was a medical doctor, and where he actually fell down was he only wanted medical doctors to train as therapists. And as you can imagine, that Venn diagram is fairly small. So that's one of the things that kind of handicapped working therapy in the States. But yes, I think if you understand work as a doctor and coming with that kind of background, it does make more sense that he might have seen patients in states of partial undress. I mean, I don't work with that. I don't work like that. I wasn't worked on like that. And there's two issues of disability. There's so many, therapy has changed so much since Reich's day, since the 50s. One of the things, probably one of the most significant kind of changes, is what I'd call the kind of relational turn, where the importance of the therapeutic relationship is really brought into therapy and really highlighted. And some later kind of, I suppose, post-Reichian therapists have, there's a guy in the UK called Nick Totten, whose type of therapy is called embodied relating, where he's thinking not just about breaking down character armor, which is the kind of thing you get from Reich. He's thinking about the nature of the relationship between the therapist and therapy. Reich was writing before, I don't know if you're familiar with Carl Rogers at all. Carl Rogers, I see Rogers as kind of reacting to Freud and getting away from the very sort of complex intellectual formulations you get with Freud and getting back down to being with a particular client. There's a non-directivity with Rogerian person-centered counselling where you don't direct, where you try and elicit from the patient. The idea is that Rogers said something, I can't remember the quote exactly, but he said something like, the patient knows exactly what they need. And that's a kind of, that's a philosophical kind of difference with Reichian therapy, which can be quite directive and interventionist, as opposed to assuming that the patient knows what they need. And in practice, I would switch between the two. You know, I would switch between the two modalities. I certainly don't assume I know exactly what someone needs, and I'm not going to listen to their feedback. That would be dreadful therapy, of, you know, I think fairly obviously. But I might try a little bit of direction as well. I might be, well, you know, what is it like if you breathe differently? What is it like if you lie down and as you're lying on the couch, if you, say, for instance, push your feet down and raise your hips, what does that kind of do? So in practice, I tend to switch between the two. As for disability and difference, again, it's the time Reich was writing. Most of the psychotherapeutic stuff was written in the 30s and 40s, and it reflects the values of that day. The idea of writing about a person of colour, their experience of therapy, just didn't happen. I mean, homosexuality was still illegal, so writing about a queer experience, it doesn't happen. But in body psychotherapy generally, I think there's a movement to think about those kind of concerns. I sent you a link to Nick Totten's latest book, which is all about difference, and I'm pleased to see both kind of things emerging. I wouldn't take Herskovitz as absolutely representative of contemporary practice. I mean, you know, we were joking before the recording started, but there's a couple of bits in that book that are like, if I wanted to get struck off, that's what I would do, you know.
Yeah, and we'll go ahead and we'll put a link to Nick Totten's book in the show notes. Yeah, that'll be a good one for folks. Yeah, Adam or Will, feel free to hop in.
It's particularly important, exactly, Dan, to navigate that tension, because also just to think about the historical context in which Reich was writing in, also from sort of the side of, he's being chased by fascists throughout Europe at this point. You know, he's the only author to have his work burned by both the Nazis and the United States. You know, it's, I mean, even you talk about the writing about the psychotherapy of the queer experience, that, you know, there was some writing that happened, but that was the Institute for Sexual Wissenschaft. That was Hirschfeld, and that was all burned, and he, you know, died in exile in Paris. So there is definitely a restrictive tension there between sort of public acceptability and sort of the novelty of what he's writing there. And I mean, in terms of Reich's writing, particularly in the stuff you suggested for us, there is that definitely that tension which I think you suggest you navigate by sort of going between sort of the Rogers and the Reich sort of modality, which is between this constant rallying against normalization. So, you know, Reich describes in, I quote, you know, he says, the great error of homo normalis, because conceptual error is to believe in normality. And I think this is kind of one of the most radical things about Reich. And yet when we get to Herskovitz, there's this tension there, because in deconstructing normality by looking at the body, the way they look at the body is already sort of colored by normality as such. So maybe, for example, gait analysis, you know, or just like looking at, you know, they're comparing the body, like, where is it tense in compared to what? And they're comparing it to the standard. And so I think navigating that tension is interesting, particularly because what you mentioned about how medicalized early Reichian therapy is. And if anything, it seems like the tension actually isn't with science in the sense, but with medicine, or with the history of the very strict categorizing, very normalizing power of medicine as such, and what body that presupposes. So would you agree with that to the extent that there's a sort of a tension in Reichian therapy, not necessarily between the scientific aspects, because we have the James Strick, we have the experiments, we can retry them actually now the archives are open, but more so about the tension between the therapeutic relationship and the history of medicine itself?
Yeah. But I think, and I wouldn't confine that just to Reichian therapy, I'd say that's true of therapy in general. There's a tension, like, to me, that had come down to, like, medicine is basically this body of expertise, right? You know what to do. So much of therapy is about not knowing. And if I know about a patient's experience, that's something I should be suspicious about myself. If I'm more expert on someone's experience than they are themselves, then that's something to, but I do not trust, but I would not trust about myself. So I'd say there's a tension between unknowing as a positive value in psychotherapy and versus the certainties of medicine.
And Reich actually does a decent job articulating this, right? When he says that there is actually some sort of, he gives an account of the development of the sciences, you know, very quickly in a few pages. It's not just the history of medicine. You know, it's a history of a particular kind of norm and the set of objects that are in relation to that norm. You know, what does it mean to be, you know, it's very different to be a normal subject under early industrial capitalism and, you know, 21st century post-industrial information imperial core capitalism, right? The two very different kinds of norms, because there are different modes of social reproduction and everything. So, you know, the field of problems that the analyst is going to have to address are going to be different, you know, and this is why I think there's a fundamental difference between Reich and Freud is, you know, as Adorno describes Freud as like a symptomatologist of capitalism, right? Freud seems deeply dependent on the bourgeois family, right? And a transhistoricality to it that has to be, you know, placed over. And this will be, you know, the target of critique for everyone from, you know, Felix Guattari and so on. But for Reich, he's really trying to look for not a substance, right? He's not looking for like a basic substance upon which he's going to hang his hat. But again, it's this dang motion. Like, I'm stuck here. I don't like, and you know, so the way in which this motion is sort of deployed, like, I, for some reason, I'm more interested in the bion than I am in the Oregon. And I'm wondering, you know, let's put it let's theoretically prop up another world, right? Let's say Reich actually had the capacity and time to do the kind of research that he did, you know, regarding, I think it was plant life, right, that he was focusing on. And how would that have, if he was able to shift his focus rather than from the apparatus of the Oregon to this more sort of bio-vital kind of thing going on with the bio, how would that have informed, do you think, his approach to practice?
I think he did inform his approach to practice. I think he draws very clear analogies. I can't remember where off the top of my head, but between the pulsation of amoeba and bions with the bodies of the analands in the therapy room. He's very, very clear about that. He talks about, so for instance, amoeba encountering toxic substances and recoiling from them. And he talks about that as a type of proto-armoring, even a type of pulling away and a holding in. And also, if you do ever see any video of bions, in terms of talking about movement, they have a dancing quality. It's really strange. They look like life because they're moving. Maybe I'm falling into the trap of Reichian craziness, possibly. You can't help but end up there when I'm talking about a microscopic organism dancing, but that's what it looks like. And I suppose for anybody who wonders what on earth we're talking about now, the bions were, Reich ended up, he wanted to see if his orgasm formula, which is his formulaic representation of charge and discharge, he wanted to see if that was a fundamental part of the life process. So he started experimenting with microbiology and organisms, and he examined things at this huge level of magnification, but much, much higher than was the standard in the day. And he examined living tissue rather than tissue that had been made, or living tissue and living plant matter rather than things that had been stained. And he found these things he called the transitional objects, maybe, between the living and the non-living, called bions. And I know a variety of people who've repeated his experiments, and I can send you some video if you like there.
Yeah, we'll add that to the show notes too. Yeah, we would definitely love to see that. One thing that I thought was fascinating about Reich's theory is that there's a through line that goes not through the practice, not only into science, but into politics as well. And, you know, certain cognitive beliefs that people have bring to bear on their physical condition. And I was wondering if you see, or like with the analysands that you work with, is there a level to which that you have to work with them at a cognitive level beyond just the physical stuff that you do? And how does Reich's theory sort of play into, for example, like, okay, we're working on the body, we're working on loosening the jaw and so forth, but then we're going to investigate maybe how this is impacting certain ideas that I have about my immediate family, for example, or the socio-political system within which we live. Can you make a comment on that? Like, what have you seen on the ground?
Well, people's ideas about the family and the family configurations they find themselves in, they certainly change in the process of therapy. I don't really see as much of a link between the immediate social political and what people are exploring in the therapy room. It tends to be more because armoring, or however we want to frame people's difficulties, it seems to come together in the early years, the Freudian sort of infantile and the experience of the family growing up. So I would say that's a more family dynamics are more likely to emerge rather than immediate social political ones, if that makes sense. And one of the things that sometimes happens, doesn't happen all the time, but one of the interesting things that can happen that points again to the links between psych and soma is the recovery of spontaneous memories. People sometimes, as they're breathing, memories will just emerge spontaneously without necessarily any prompting from me. It's just things that had to come out. We'll just bubble up and people will start sharing them with me. It's quite amazing when that happens, actually. I remember the first time that happened with me and a client. I was like, I wouldn't say I was surprised, but I was like, wow, that's a pretty amazing thing. I would draw, I wrote a Twitter thread about this, drawing a loose analogy between breathing and breath work and free association, because free association is about, is about using spontaneity to get to the unconscious to present itself. I would argue that breath work you can see working with the breath, you can also see as a kind of free association, because it's a kind of, it's a way in which things can come free and rise to the surface. And I've seen that a number of times.
What does Reichian therapy do when it comes to things like habits, obsessive compulsive disorder, or what they call obsessive compulsive disorder, or even just like drinking or smoking? How does that relate to Reich's concept of emotional armoring?
I might try and think of that as being a particular presentation of armoring, but I don't necessarily know what I would work with, I would work with that in that way. I might, for instance, use a sort of person-centered approach, and with sort of OCD stuff, because people are so used to running into criticism because of it, so used to criticizing themselves, my sort of way into it would probably be to try and normalize it and to try and depathologize it, which I could twist that around and I could fit it into an armoring, a Reichian frame if I wanted to, but I would begin there. Like, there's standard ideas that animate practice, but when you're in the room with a client, something an old therapist of mine said to me years ago has always stuck with me. And she said, you've got to learn to be the therapist that particular client needs. So that might mean not doing any Reichian ideas whatsoever. I mean, rejecting that completely. I've had clients who said, oh, I don't want to do any of the physical work, thank you. So I'm not fine. Yeah, let's not do that. I might ask them why, and I might say, what are your reactions to the physical work that we've done, or what are your feelings about doing that? But practice, I guess, can be so kind of protean. It's hard to have a standard, this is what I do. I would say I'd be a worse therapist if I had a, this is what I do kind of answer. I've a heavy orientation towards the body and getting people to work with their breath, but it's not all that I do.
I think that's probably where most people take a stand back a bit from Reich, in terms of when they think of the image, they think of, you know, Woody Allen's The Orgasmatron, and they think of, especially with, that's the thing, quacks know what they know what you need, because they're trying to sell it to you, whereas Reichian's experimental, general sort of open. I mean, I think James Strich once described him as a 19th century scientist in the 20th century, which allowed him to be that kind of polymath. But one bit of curiosity I do just had to get off my chest: the boxes, because they are kind of the archetypal image. Is there still any sort of mass use of, because I know if you go to the Organon in up north in the States, but like
there isn't a mass use, but mass use of anything with Reich makes me kind of laugh a bit, because there's so kind of little practical interest. But the weird thing about the Organon accumulator is it just works. Like how Reich said, you sit in one, what he said happens, which is normally a subjective sensation of energy. It feels like static electricity, but it isn't. It feels like static. The closest sensation I have is like static electricity, but it isn't static electricity. Your temperature goes up. You feel sort of kind of parasympathetic relaxation. And that's what happens where when you sit in one, you can, I feel like I can feel it with my hands fairly clearly. And when that happens, you just go, oh, right. Ah, this is what he was talking about. But the history, you look at the history of the, because, you know, if you talk to someone who doesn't know a lot about the subject, they'll say, oh, yeah, look, you know, but they have some passing knowledge. They'll say, oh, right, it was a crank and all that stuff was disproved. The FDA's trials back in the 50s were biased from the off, and they've never been published, so we don't know what they proved. And that's the only kind of clinical disproof that I'm aware of. I don't think they've been subject to large-scale trials. I'd like to see it one day, but with Reich's reputation, I'm not holding my breath. But, I mean, I would say if you're interested, build one if you have the space. I do not have the space, but I've sat in one at a friend's house a lot, and I can attest it's, yeah, work, as he said. What one of the really irritating Guardian level type of discourse about that is, but Reich said they'll cure cancer and make you spontaneously orgasm, and neither of those things are true. Yeah. Cancer remission and spontaneous orgasms. So I hate to disappoint the listeners, but then yeah, they're not happening.
Unfortunately, right? Yeah. Will, go ahead.
So I've got a less philosophically, scientifically dense question. Have you heard the song Cloud Busting by Kate Bush? What do you think of the song Cloud Busting by Kate Bush? And does the sort of Cloudbuster as a machine, what is it, first of all? And what's its relation to the Orgone? And yeah, how does it show sort of the vastness of Reich's, not only the basis of Reich's theory, but of his kind of eclectic pursuit?
I would say the song in Kate Bush in general is fantastic. You know, it's based on her reading Peter Reich's book, who was Reich's son. He wrote a book called A Book of Dreams, which is a little mini autobiography about having such a strange father, and that's what it's about. She's quite pro-Reich. I posted something on Twitter that came out recently, a Hounds of Love repress in a nice box, and she's made this really lovely film, which is meant to be Peter Reich talking about that song, and that's quite recent. So I assume Kate Bush is still pro-Reich, which makes it even cooler, in my opinion, if you can be cooler than Kate Bush. But Cloudbuster, in a lot of ways, it's like the ultimate test of like credibility. And I can't think of the right word, but it's kind of like, can you believe in something so challenging? It seems like a test to me of credibility, the idea, not credibility is not the right word, but it's almost like it's designed to test how far one will go in one's beliefs. But having said that, because of my experiences with the Orgone accumulator, Reich has credit with me. You know, I'm not going to run around trying to convince people that Cloudbusters work and we can change the weather and all the rest of it. But it's been right so far. What I have seen is it's convincing. So yeah, I wouldn't dismiss the idea at all, but it's a challenging one. Yeah. I don't really understand the mechanics of it fully. I certainly don't understand it well enough to talk about it. There's an excellent book called The Healing of Atmospheres by Roberto Maglione, which talks about Cloudbusters. And there was a guy, he died a couple of years ago now, James DiMeo. He was in Texas. He was probably the leading authority on Cloudbusters. I know he's a good case in point on what happens when you try and talk about Reich. I think he was refused his graduate diploma or something from the University of Texas because he was talking about Cloudbusters, and they were like, no. And he spent his career looking into them as far as I know, but I don't know that much about his work. But he would be the first person I would look at if I wanted to find out more.
You have really reawakened my curiosity in the Orgone accumulator. I live in the woods and I know exactly where I would build it. So I'm going to get on Google after this and see what I can do as a summer project. But anyway, Dan, I just want to say thank you for being with us here today. It was a real pleasure to have you. Before you go, I'm just going to throw an assortment of three questions out at you, and you're welcome to answer all of them or none of them. The first question would be, as a Reichian therapist, or just as a therapist in general, what do you consider either your greatest or your most regular success with your analysands? In addition to that, as most of us won't be going into Reichian therapy, what do you think is really the best takeaway that we can get from an engagement with Reich on the page? And if you'd like, are you open to taking clients where you're at in London? And would you be interested in leaving your information with us?
Sure. Yeah, of course. To answer the last question first, yeah, of course. I'll send you a link to my current profile. I'm in the process of, I've been setting up a website forever and failing to do so for a million reasons. I'll send you a link to my current BACP profile. The second question, what would be the takeaway from Reich? I think to think about your body and to think about your breath and to allow for the possibility of energy. Just to, what do you get if you reorientate yourself towards your body for, you know, and your breath in particular for a small period of time? I think anybody could, I mean, breath work is becoming this, it's become very trendy again. And I think there's probably a lot of very interesting breath work practitioners out there. And I would think it's something worth exploring and investigating if these ideas are at all interesting to you. There's one book, Reichian Therapy for Home Use by Jack Willis, and Christopher Hyatt used his ideas in Undoing Yourself with Energized Meditation, which is a sort of pseudo Reichian therapy that people can work on at home. I have a sort of beef with Jack Willis because he says, oh, Reich's ideas about energy were all wrong. But that's an interesting book. But if anyone does end up experimenting with this stuff at home, handle with care. It can be very powerful. So, yeah, it can be. I was talking to a friend the other day and he says he can normally manage about 3 minutes of the breathing before he feels like his head's about to explode. So it's kind of, and handle with care. And what was the first question again?
Your greatest success, or maybe your most regular success that you experience in the counseling room?
I think I don't want to sort of breach confidentiality and talk about specific pieces of work with clients. I was pleased with myself recently when I managed to hold space, not really do anything. I was with someone who's psychotic, and I was pleased that I just managed to, Reichian work is essentially about contact. And I wasn't working with this guy in a Reichian way at all, but I think I managed to establish contact with him. And that was a piece of work afterwards. I was well pleased with what I'd done.
Great. Well, Dan, once again, thank you. I think this has been informative and it's really satisfied my curiosities about the things that I didn't know about Reich. And definitely, if you're listening, all of us here have read The Mass Psychology of Fascism. I highly recommend Ether, God, and Devil as a follow-up text to that if you have already had a brush with Reich. Thanks again, Dan.